Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Abigail Walls, Simon Schuster, Jacob Kanzler, and John Rurik. A little later, Valerie Brader is going to be joining us to talk about the impact of the energy legislation, get her comments on that. Jacob was able to sit down and speak with her. But first, we're going to conclude our series on legislators and political figures of the year with our House Member of the Year and our Political Figure of the Year. As I mentioned last week, every year we recognize those legislators who have gone above and beyond and had particularly very good years in the areas of being effective, level of activity, and the impact that they've had on the political process. We nominate five people who we feel best kind of embody those categories. And we're going to start right now with our House Member of the Year and our first nominee. And our first nominee, John, we're going to go with Eric Nesbitt.
Eric Nesbitt, he pulled off something that hasn't been done since 1992, kind of guiding the Republican caucus to a point where they didn't lose any seats this year in a presidential election, which is indeed a rare feat. Combine that with his work on energy, and you've got kind of a winning record that certainly sets him out as a distinct candidate for this award.
Republicans haven't picked up a House seat in a presidential election since 1992.
I know it.
And Republicans held serve here. And Nesbitt was kind of thrust into this position as well. We had a leadership race going on. There was concerns about Verhulen versus Leonard. And could any one of them use their position to try and advance their bid to be Speaker? And Eric Nesbitt said, I'll step in and I'll take over and do what I did in 2014. And with success, I would say, wouldn't you, Abby?
Absolutely. I think that, at least in my mind, the most impressive thing about Nesbitt's year is that he set out his own list of three things he wanted to accomplish. And actually, I mean, one of them was getting married. Congratulations. The other two, you know, were to hold House majority and to pass the energy package. And I mean, it's not often that people set goals that high and actually accomplish them.
You know, the energy package, Jacob, was obviously the focus was in the Senate this year, but they still needed to get the 55 votes in the House to get this thing passed. Not a small feat, considering Gary Glenn was pushing back very hard, and there was a very strong conservative contingent in the House who really were ambivalent at best and opposed to it at worst. And he was still able to help guide this thing through. Obviously, we had help with the Senate and with Governor Snyder. But, you know, this thing doesn't get done without him.
You know, obviously, the energy package ran into some resistance in the House. You have a lot of varying interests, particularly the strong advocacy for maintaining choice and just being able to wrangle up votes within his own caucus and then eventually enough to pass it on the floor. I mean, that's certainly a huge accomplishment and a huge effort to get it done.
All right. And we also want to mention here that Eric Nesbitt was one of the 13 House members who are term limited out of office, who had a perfect voting record for all 6 years in their term. I think that is also a noteworthy accomplishment. He also passed a resolution, one of the last things they did on the House floor in the year, to urge the Michigan Public Service Commission to say no to the closing of the Palisades power plant, which would impact his district. 600 jobs are on the line, and he is trying to get that nuclear power plant from shutting its doors here in the next couple of years. So a very impactful year and a very active year for Eric Nesbitt.
And one more thing we should note about him, too. This was his final term. You think about this, he got his position in leadership. He could have just as easily kind of coasted out to the end of this term, and he really didn't set some high goals and got them.
Our next nominee for House Member of the Year is Representative Tim Kelly from Saginaw. Abby, it's hard to argue there's anybody been more active this year in the House than Tim Kelly, considering his role in education, not only on the appropriation side, but on the policy side as well. Take a look at the Detroit schools issue. He was very involved in that, was very influential also in pushing this issue throughout the year, and especially as it relates to Detroit schools and their potential closing down the line, and urging the governor's office to take a hard look at closing Detroit public schools and keeping that on the front burner. And while all this is going on, he also put into the budget something I didn't think that would ever make it into a budget, but was signed and as of now is being held up in the courts, and that is $2.5 million for private schools.
Yeah, I think that's a big accomplishment for Kelly. There's some precedent for trying this, but this is basically untested. And while it got a lot of attention for a period of time in the House, and there was some concern that it wouldn't actually make it all the way through the budget process, it got signed. And I think you can't underestimate the statesmanship that has to go on to get that done.
And then, John, of course, he was also involved in the Uber legislation.
Yes, he was a key in resolving that issue that kind of had been hanging around for a long time. And if you remember, though, Kyle, we this is one guy that we gave the award to for Freshman of the Year a few years ago.
Yeah, that's right.
And he's really kind of dug in the policy issues. He's going to be the policy chair for the Republicans next session. So he's really kind of delivered on that early promise that he showed in his first term.
Jacob, what stood out for you this year with Tim Kelly?
Well, one other thing that we noticed is that earlier in the year, he chaired the K-12 appropriations, and he took out the MSTEP funding, which he said to do to start a conversation on state assessments. And that conversation is going on right now. The state is looking into, again, changing its state test, and it could be involved reducing the amount we use MSTEP. So certainly, I think he played a role in that early on.
And he also was involved in these restraint and seclusion bills, too, if I remember right. A lot of education-related issues this year. Tim Kelly was involved intimately in all of them. So for giving the Uber legislation a lift, among other important issues, I had to throw that in there. I'm sorry.
So he gets a lift to this nomination.
Tim Kelly, one of our five nominees for House Member of the Year. Okay, Abigail Walls with our next nomination.
I'd like to nominate Representative Ed McBroom for a lot of his policy work as a chair of the Oversight and Ethics Committee. He's also, you know, the dean of the House, also showed himself near the end to be the master of procedure.
That was pretty interesting at the end, where he actually got a roll call vote on an amendment, which is not a very common occurrence these days in the House.
Yeah, no, the rumor that I have been told by a member of McBroom's staff was that he actually went through and studied the night before on how to pull this off and kind of box, you know, the speaker into hearing him.
What happened here in the end, this was an amendment on the energy package having to do with trying to at least do some type of study or advance further a transmission line between the Lower Peninsula and the Upper Peninsula. The amendment failed, but the fact that we actually had a debate and a vote on an amendment is an accomplishment, sad as that may be. It was an accomplishment nonetheless. But John, he's done quite a bit of other things this year. You look at the FOIA reform. That passed the House. That didn't pass the Senate. But he's had the discussion, and for the first time, we've got some type of expansion of documents and the freedom for the public to look at what the legislature and the executive does. It's the first time we've had anything pass a chamber.
It's the first time we had anything pass a chamber. The fact that it did not get to the governor's desk is a little disconcerting for fans of FOIA reform, because I think it's, the further we get from Flint, the harder it's going to be to get that done. There's that. But there's also other issues he's worked on. There's the unemployment insurance reforms that he's worked on. That's a big deal to a lot of people who are kind of hurt by the automated adjudication crisis they had over there. So he's done a lot of things.
The Capitol Commission, the improvements that need to be made in the Capitol Dome, those also passed the House, did not pass the Senate, but he put a spotlight on the need for the internal guts of the Capitol to be repaired, the plumbing, the electrical work, got the conversation going on that, passed one chamber, also was part of the Flint water crisis, and also part of the Veterans Homes debate, and sponsored the amendment that made it clear that going forward, folks that who work in these new veteran homes that are going to be made as part of this new expansion are going to be state workers, which was a huge win for organized labor. To see that put on there was a significant accomplishment. So a lot of productive work that Ed McBroom did this year. So for those reasons, we're going to nominate him also for House Member of the Year. Okay, our next nominee for House Member of the Year is the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, Al Pasholka. And John, when you take a look at what happened with the Detroit Public Schools package this year, I think it's fair to say that the House had the big win in that. I think that what they kind of envisioned going forward as far as not having that separate Detroit Education Committee came out of the House and what they were able to do. And I think the leader on that end of things was Al Pasholka.
It was. He played a huge role in that. He's played a huge role in a number of things. What I admire about Al Pishulka is he's willing to take on some of the sacred cows of his party, kind of put the business community back on its heels by pushing the repeal of a auto insurance tax credit that really wasn't supposed to be there. That was an $80 million item. Kind of pushed that through despite lack of support from his own leader and really got it done. So that's one of the things that, you know, when you think about the ability to work the system, that you got to admire.
Abby, it just seems like there's a lot of little things also, if you look through the process, that he had an involvement in the zero tolerance policy. He had legislation on the medically frail and then calls of defense for people who make 911 calls when somebody's having an overdose.
Yeah, I mean, I think being appropriations chair can be an all-consuming task. It's by no means small. And you scroll through the sponsorship list for Representative Pishulka this year, and you see that he didn't let, I mean, there were things that he, big packages that he got a bill into. Whether or not he let it is a different question, but it seemed, you know, he seems to have a knack for what is important, what's a priority, and gets involved.
What stood out to you, Simon?
Yeah, I think that, you know, for someone who is an appropriations chair, especially in their final term, it can easy to just fall into the role simply of a gatekeeper. And I think Representative Pishulka is a good example of a legislator who's made an effort to put his personal stamp on a lot of pieces of legislation that, you know, simply mattered to him.
And I think that in recognition of that, Jacob, there were other people who kind of recognized that he has been extremely active and extremely effective in his role.
Yeah, and one thing I want to add is, Pierre, but obviously as the appropriations chair was amenable and worked on the various Flint supplementals, and while trying to work on that, also trying to apply some scrutiny to what funds go where and how they're used.
The HICA reform and deciding how we're going to draw down our Medicaid funding also was something that Al Pishulka had a role in. So there's a lot of different packages, and now I think the administration's taken a strong look at him as far as bringing him in.
Do you think he'd be a great budget chair, though? I'm really looking forward to the presentations if that's who they are. I think it could be a lot of fun.
I don't know if you guys remember this, but in 2014, our House Member of the Year was John Walsh, and John Walsh then got a job in the administration.
You're right. That's a perfect point. And another thing, you know, this is, I don't know if you mentioned it, but Al Pishulka had one of the perfect voting records too, right?
Oh, he did have a perfect voting record. Yeah. That's right. Okay. Okay, so we've got a ton of reasons why he should be a nominee, and indeed he is. Al Pishulka, one of our nominees for House Member of the Year. Okay, our last nominee for House Member of the Year. We're not trying to make this a trend or anything, but as we were talking about people who had a very effective year in the House, it's hard not to talk about Harvey Santana, the Democrat from Detroit, also in his final term. I want to take everyone back to the beginning of the year when the governor was talking about needing to bail out the city of Detroit. He never used the term bail out because that has a certain stench to it that folks find repugnant. But Harvey Santana took it upon himself to drive individual House members down to Detroit and take them through the schools and actually show them what a Detroit school looks like and put a face to this issue. And I think Harvey Santana, maybe more than anyone else, had a very real impact in getting the House to recognize that something had to be done as far as the state getting involved in the Detroit public school debate. He did that on his own time. He didn't need to do that. He's been extremely effective on other fronts too, I think, John.
He's been very effective. And one of the things I admire about him is he is a caucus of one. He is kind of in this day when the members of the House seem to march in lockstep with their partisan identities. He's stepped out and said, I'm not going to do that. He's been very effective at working with Republican leadership in terms of getting things for his district throughout his career. And that kind of is a hallmark that I think is certainly worth recognizing, sort of break with that partisan lock.
You know, it's been very interesting too, Abby. You take a look as him being the ranking member on appropriations, and he's been able to work with Democrats and Republicans while getting stuff done for his district. I was taking a look at another thing that he was able to do, this sidewalk bill that the city of Detroit really wanted to try and put some type of controls on the lawsuits they were getting stuck with people tripping and falling on the sidewalks there in Detroit. And he, whether you agree with the policy or not, he was able to get that through the legislature despite some heavy pushback from Democrats.
Yeah, and I think it's more impressive to get things like this done when you're not relying on the machinery of your caucus to help you along the way. It seemed, at least from our perspective, that he really had to work each issue individually on his own. It's not often you see somebody who not only separates from their caucus, but is also highly effective.
And I would agree with that. You take a look at issues like juvenile justice. He was a leader in the animal abuse legislation that got notably neutered there at the end, no pun intended, but he still got something passed, which I think is extremely noteworthy. The juvenile justice thing, I think, is an issue that will carry over into the next term. And also worked with folks like Stephanie Chang, getting some momentum behind the driver's license bill to get driver's license in the hands of immigrants in the state. Several reasons to nominate Harvey Santana for our House Member of the Year. All right, our crew here has gone through various discussions and talked about arguments for all five individuals here that we have nominated. But in the end, we are going to choose Eric Nesbitt as our House Member of the Year. You take a look at where the House Republican Campaign Committee was earlier this year. There was a lot of talk that Hillary Clinton was going to roll through this state and pick up some mad wins, and the House was going to get knocked down. And it wasn't a question of if, it was how many seats they were going to lose. And in the end, Eric Nesbitt held serve and didn't lose any seats, even though this position was thrust upon him because of internal politics. He was able to pick it up and run while also getting through arguably the toughest piece of legislation this time around, a caucus that last year told Nesbitt we are not interested in pursuing. He was able to get the votes together to get this thing passed, and just not 55, was able to get a strong, strong majority of the entire chamber to support this bill, working with the governor's office and Mike Knopf's, something that didn't look like it was going to get pulled off 2 days before lame duck. He was able to help pull the rabbit out of the hat, make it happen. A very successful year for Eric Nesbitt. So congratulations to Representative Nesbitt, our House Member of the Year. We're going to do something a little different this year. We're going to start a new award that I'd really like to do every 2 years, because I think it's particularly prudent in election year to recognize that figure who was the politician of the year, or political figure of the year is how I want to define this category, because it doesn't necessarily have to be an individual. It can be a group or any type of association, somebody that's had a particularly effective, active, and impactful year. And you take a look at this election year, John, and I think there's some folks who really stand out as having an effective year. Why don't you go ahead with our first nominee?
I'm going to put into nomination the name of one Betsy DeVos. She's had a very effective year. She was instrumental in changing the Detroit Public School rescue package to eliminate what she and charter school advocates found offensive in terms of the Detroit Education Commission. She certainly played a hand in the third grade reading effort. Now she's been nominated as Secretary of Education, and I think she's both an individual and an organization when you think about sort of GLEP's record. They were very effective in terms of their the role they played in electing members of the incoming legislature. So
let's take a look at this here. The Great Lakes Education Project, which Betsy DeVos and her husband Dick DeVos are extremely active in, had 41 of the 44 people that they endorsed in the primary were successful. Mm-hmm. Now, some of these were gimmies because they were incumbents and were going to win, but by any measure, 41 of 44 is pretty good.
It's a very good record. And, you know, the DeVos's are a lightning rod couple in a lot of ways. You either really like them or you really don't. But you can't really argue with the fact that they've had a big impact in 2016, that she's had a big impact in 2016.
And we didn't even mention the money aspect of this either. Betsy DeVos, Dick DeVos, and their family, the amount of money that they've given to the House Republicans this time around, at a time when they really needed it. It seemed like their money coming in late really did prove to be a big boost mm-hmm. for Republicans, and played a huge role in them holding serve and keeping the 63 seats in the House.
Absolutely. It was a big play.
So for that and all the reasons we mentioned, Betsy DeVos will be one of our nominees for Political Figure of the Year. Our next nominee for Political Figure of the Year, John, is going to be Ronna Romney McDaniel, chair of the Michigan Republican Party. You take a look at the year that she's had, John, it's hard to argue that she doesn't deserve to be in this conversation. She had a nominee for president, Donald Trump, that at many points during this year looked like a political stink bomb that was going to sink everybody on the ticket here from top to bottom. And what happened here?
She ran the board in a lot of ways when you look at the races. I mean, the House, obviously, we've talked about that. They're keeping their exact same number. She made gains on education boards, which is practically unheard of. Presidential year, kept the Republicans balanced in terms of the congressional seats. She really did an excellent job in terms of holding onto what they had and building on what they had.
It had to be very difficult to hold this Republican Party together as the ship was sailing down the sea with Donald
Donald Trump as the top of the ticket, and she did it, and did it really well.
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, people were looking at Donald Trump's candidacy as this was something that you had to build a bulwark against. That you know, the question was not whether or not they're going to take on water, but how much they're going to take on, and you know, how well they would fare. But really, she doubled down and consolidated power after Donald Trump's nomination and said that either you are behind this candidate or you are not with this party in a lot of senses, while also giving people enough leeway to not necessarily explicitly be against the candidate, but she at least implored them to keep quiet.
Well, and we mentioned Wendy Day. Wendy Day was part of the vice chair circle in the Republican Party, and Wendy Day was speaking out against the nominee. She took a hard stand, say, you know what, you can't serve in a function within the Republican Party and be against Donald Trump. You can be against Donald Trump, that's fine, say whatever you want, but if you're going to be part of this apparatus, Abby, you got to support the nominee.
Well, yeah, and I think it's also impressive to not get in politics. I mean, name ID is the first rule of electoral politics, and I think it is a testament to her ability as a politician to not get sunk in this presidential year by her own last name. To not get sunk by the Romney name and to, in fact, rise to be the RNC chair in an environment where Romney could be treated very hostily and was by a president-elect, to move past that, I think, is a high credential.
Yeah, I think that this is in many ways a year in which the tent in which composes the Republican Party underwent a fundamental sea change. And despite, you know, her last name, as Abby said, and her own uncle, who was vehemently against the presidential nominee, that she was able to, you know, really kind of help the party at the state level undergo that metamorphosis and emerge, you know, largely unscathed is quite impressive.
Yeah, not only emerge unscathed, but blossom, being nominated to be the next Republican committee chair for the entire country, John. It's a great honor for the state of Michigan to have one of our own be the RNC chair, and Ronna Romney looks like that's going to happen for next year. So for all those reasons, Ronna Romney McDaniel, another nominee for our political figure of the year. Okay, Abigail Walls with our next nominee.
Well, I think it was a little hometown pride here when I choose to nominate Senator Dave Kinesic. I'm from Dearborn Heights. I'm from Dearborn, though. Slightly better of the two cities. Anyway, Senator Dave Kinesic as politician of the year. You know, he has something of a kingmaker in the Dearborn suburbs area. I guess you say downriver area. You know, we were talking about with Darren Camilleri in the 23rd. He has a strong relationship with Abdullah Hamoud in the 15th. He had a role in Julie Plawecki taking the 11th district and replacement by Joelle Jones and Lauren Plawecki. Like, he really is active. And then he's also an active fundraiser for his caucus. I think we wrote back in October that he and Senator Hertel were on track to be top non-leadership contributors to their caucus. And he's on track to contribute $100,000 by the end of the year.
Let's emphasize to what happened in the 23rd House District, because he was extremely active in helping Darren Camilleri win there. That was the only competitive seat that the Democrats were able to pick up. So with the wind at their face, that was another seat that could have totally gone the Republicans' way. He helped Camilleri win that seat. And the role that he played also, the kingmaker aspect, I don't think can be overstated there in the 11th Congressional District. He had a huge hand in the 11th House District in getting first Lauren Plawecki and then Joelle Jones in those positions there. So a very good year, and a guy after my own heart. And this should, I don't know if you can put this in the political figure of the year category, but he ran a marathon on stress fractures on his foot, which earns bonus points as far as I'm concerned. That's pretty awesome.
Well, I think it is. And our resident tech person, Simon Schuster, can comment more on this. But I think there is something like the marathon and the way that Senator Kinesic puts a lot of his life and personal anecdotes on Facebook. If you really dig into his likes, it's a matrix of Lansing insiders and like just folks from the district or the area. I mean, he's a little bit of Mr. Smith Goes to Washington in there.
All right. So for all those reasons, David Kinesic, one of our nominees for Political Figure of the Year. Simon Schuster with our next nominee.
Yeah, well, I would like to nominate the mayor of Flint, Karen Weaver. Now, my nomination, of course, is going to bleed a little bit into 2015. But if you recall back at the end of October of that year, there's not a lot of people saying that she had much of a shot at the mayorship. This was before the full scope of the Flint water crisis had been known, but this was something that she was very much aware of. She was on the streets, and she was hitting doors, and she was seeing that this is something that really mattered to people. And she was able to connect that to the incumbent Democratic mayor, Dane Walling and defeat him to win the mayorship. Now, when she came into office, facing, you know, obviously an enormous issue, which has become increasingly entrenched and very partisan, she instead was able to walk a fine line, work with, you know, a Republican state legislature, a Republican governor, and speak with them and collaborate and find ways that, you know, could work towards Flint and really advocate for her city in an effective manner. To the same extent, she was also able to leverage her position as a mayor of a city that is in the throes of crisis to kind of take on the national stage. You know, she went to a national conference of mayors where she had a speaking slot. She spoke at the Democratic National Convention. And she's someone who, you know, was 18 months ago was a clinical psychologist with no political experience.
It is interesting to note, John, that the presidential primary debate earlier this year was held in Flint. That's a small part of the work that Karen Weaver did to make this a national story.
She did do a good job of making that a national story, but she also made it a very partisan story in the way she handled the whole presidential election. You recall they shooed Donald Trump away from even anywhere, getting anywhere near Flint. It was a completely different reaction when it came to Hillary Clinton using the city as sort of a campaign prop. I do want to make sure that we make note of that.
There's no question that she had a very impactful year. She was extremely active, has been coming up here multiple times to try and work with Republicans to try and get stuff done for her city, and I think is very deserving of at least the nomination here for Political Figure of the Year. Okay, our last nominee for Political Figure of the Year is going to be the U.S. Congressman-elect Jack Bergman in the 1st Congressional District. You go back to the beginning of the year, you take a look at Dan Benishek, he's going to be stepping down. He's going to adhere to his own term limits ban that he put on himself. And Jack Bergman came out of nowhere. He was kind of the afterthought outside of Jason Allen and Tom Casperson, and really took this race extremely seriously. He said that he had access to money. Nobody knew who he was. He was from the military. Did he really live in Watersmeet? A lot of questions right off the bat, John.
I'm laughing because it was one of my favorite interviews of the year, talking to him on the phone, and it was when a lot of people didn't give him any credence at all as a candidate, and he kind of laid out his exact plan. He's, I've got everything planned out. I know when to do it, when, how to do it. I kind of chuckled. I remember was telling you, this guy, you know, he's not going to go anywhere, and sure enough, he followed his plan. He executed his plan exactly in a kind of military style, and he came out on top.
I was just really impressed by the way he was able to kind of get together the conservative movement, and I think really took this race seriously from the very beginning, and was able to round the people up that he needed to, talk to the people that he needed to talk to, and put himself in a very strong position at the very beginning, and took advantage of an anti-politician atmosphere this time around, Abby, that really caught fire at the end.
Yeah, which is a good trick to pull off if you've actually been in elected office before or been working in Washington, D.C. in some. If you do have experience with the job and you're able to highlight other parts of your history and your personality to sort of shed that in a way that's authentic, that's believable. I mean, there were some heavy shots lobbed at him during the campaign about what his background really, really is like. And I think that Bergman did a good job of staying on message, staying on his plan, and not getting derailed by explaining himself or his experience away.
Yeah, he was very Teflon when it came to that. He was described as a lobbyist, and he really batted that away and really used his military experience for a huge benefit.
And I think he was smart, too. When hits started rolling at his general election opponent, you know, Lon Johnson, he did a good job of staying far, far away from the actual, from actually having pulled the trigger, which is, you know, which is highly effective in this kind of setting.
And when the final vote was taken, really wasn't close in the 1st Congressional District. And a lot of that, you could say, had to do with the type of year and Donald Trump. But you can't discount that Jack Bergman ran a very good campaign and really earned himself that position in Congress. And then to be nominated by his colleagues as the head freshman in that delegation. That's a great honor for him.
I talked to him recently about that, and he just said, you know, I'm focused on getting, while I'm here in Washington, getting my staff together, getting my district staff together. This is, you know, staying kind of in the footsteps of his predecessor, of this is about the district and secondarily about D.C.
So Jack Bergman, our final nominee for Political Figure of the Year. All right, after a very good discussion here where we had a good debate between really two very successful political figures this year, Ronna Romney McDaniel and Betsy DeVos, we have decided to give our Political Figure of the Year award to Betsy DeVos. And the reason is because I think that Ronna Romney, while she did a great job, dealing with the cards that were dealt with her, in being put in a position to have to defend Donald Trump, prop him up, and ride the surge and guide the surge through to victory. Betsy DeVos didn't have to play this game this time around. She didn't have to participate in Team Trump. She didn't have to go to Cleveland and go to the Republican convention, yet she played a role in that. And not only did that, but then helped the Republicans along the way, the Republican caucus, to maintain their majority, and had an active role in the fundraising aspect of it, and have an enormous impact in the policy arena here at the state capitol with the DPS package, with the third grade reading package, and with the GLEP, Great Lakes Education Project, with her husband, Dick DeVos, and influence policy in this state. And whether you like it or not, Betsy DeVos's hands were all over the place and had a huge role that was recognized by the president-elect of the United States and being named to his cabinet, which I think really just kind of accentuates the power that she had over the political system in this state, and really kind of rises above to be our political figure of the year, Betsy DeVos.
All right, joining us for the MERS Monday podcast is Valerie Brader. She is the director of the Michigan Agency for Energy. Valerie, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk the energy package. The governor, as we're recording today, signed the energy package today. Long time in the coming. A lot of work went into it. My question for you now is kind of, what's next? What happens next on the state level? What happens on the utilities level? We talked a lot about how this was needed to kind of shore up our energy future. And so the legislation is, if I understand it correctly, kind of helps set up that to happen. So what is now allowed to happen that can happen next with this energy legislation?
Well, what we're really looking at is 120 days from today, these laws will come into effect. That has a whole series of proceedings. One of them, which is related to something we'll have a federal decision on by March 1st, we hope, which is this new system for making sure everybody pays for the capacity they rely on. So I would say we're expecting to see that as something that we'll already have action on even before the law takes effect, or if not, one of the first things we'll have to look at doing.
Yeah, explain that for our listeners again, because this request, which I think you guys are going to be putting into MISO, that came before the energy legislation passed. And so how does that interplay with what the legislation does, and kind of what does that request set out to do in terms of the alternative energy providers?
Yeah, well, sort of on a national scale, we've seen states and the federal government clash repeatedly twice before the U.S. Supreme Court just this last term about where the jurisdiction lies for reliability. So what's really exciting about this proposal is that Michigan teamed up with the MISO, the folks who run our grid, to have a joint proposal for how we could meld the federal jurisdiction that they exercise through the FERC and the state level jurisdiction. And we're waiting for FERC to approve that, but that really came about through some negotiations and was announced in the fall. And that really served as the basis for a lot of the legislation, which now has the ability to use that as an obvious path for Michigan. And if the federal government doesn't act, doesn't put that into place, it really forms the nexus of what our backup plan is too.
Can I explain again what that is trying to do? I think this is about kind of ensuring that alternative energy suppliers prove or show that they are going to have energy to give their customers that choose to go to them.
Yeah, essentially what we have is a system where if there isn't enough supply for everybody, nobody gets any power because our grid relies on supply and demand matching. So when there isn't enough supply, it can be a real problem. This assures that everybody has to line up supply at least 3 years in advance. And if the alternative electric suppliers don't have that, then we give the utilities that are regulated the time and the money to go out and procure it. And we work with the federal government to help us know how much we have to buy and whether what gets bought qualifies for the reliability requirements.
And so this needs official approval from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, correct?
Correct.
Now, can you kind of give us a prognosis, since a lot of people in Michigan probably aren't familiar with the politics or workings of the FERC, how likely is this request going to be approved? Is this a tall ask, or is this something that might have some consensus and seems like a good idea that they would sign off on?
Well, we're optimistic that it will be approved, especially given the wide range of support that has already come in from industry, including Ford, from other utilities and states regulatorily that have authority. We're also, again, doing something that folks around the country haven't been able to do, and that's mesh federal and state jurisdictions. And I think if the FERC's been in front of the Supreme Court three times in the last 2 years on that issue, they're going to be looking to reward solutions, people who are coming forward and trying to make the jurisdictions mesh instead of fight about whose job it is.
Going back to the energy legislation, one thing I wanted to know, because it touches so many areas of energy policy, you've worked on it for so long in depth. Can you kind of give us the basics of what is this going to mean now when this goes into effect for the average residential ratepayer? I know people were worried about their rates. You know, there are some people that use some of these programs where you can generate your own energy. What is this going to mean for, you know, the Joe Smith ratepayer because of what has just happened?
So I think the biggest thing that the Joe Smith ratepayer is going to have from this is a lot more protections and a lot of ability to lower their own bills while helping everybody else out. So we have very popular programs right now that help you if you're installing insulation. There are rebates for that. If you're updating your furnace to a more efficient model, when you're replacing your refrigerator, all these things, there are programs that the utilities run to help buy down the cost of that. Those programs are going to be expanded. So folks who have had trouble looking at qualifying for those or getting in on those, they'll be more available. There will also be the potential for new tools that help your average renter get their house to be more energy efficient. We, right now, the landlord owns the house and the tenant pays the utility bills, so why would you ever get insulation, right? There's a mechanism called on-bill financing that wasn't permitted for investor-owned utilities like DT and consumers that got lifted as part of this legislation. So I think your average homeowner is going to get a chance to participate in our cheapest, cleanest form of energy, and that is stopping wasting energy we don't need to be spending. And also will benefit from overall a much more stringent process for comparing alternatives. The first time that process was ever used in Michigan, it helped support one of our nuclear plants that provides very low-cost energy. The second time, it resulted in an alternative that cost ratepayers $500 million less than the proposal. We're going to be using that more, and we have more rules to let alternatives come in more easily. So I think ratepayers will see that in the bottom lines on their bills, too.
Another thing our listeners might be interested in is kind of the process of how this played out as it went towards passage in lame duck. From what we understand, you and the governor were among those that was making this last minute push. Now that we're kind of after the fact, what did you and the governor have to do to get this across the finish line in those negotiations? What was the top issue? What was it really that kind of helped get to where we needed to get enough votes to get this passed?
Well, I think it was finding the right balance on a couple of issues, and where the governor was personally instrumental was in the issue of how we deal with some of these issues on the choice market, these alternative electric suppliers. There was a lot of concern, I think, of what happens if the choice market collapses, if all of a sudden, you know, hundreds and hundreds of customers are coming back to the utilities, they haven't built to serve them, they could leave again, how do they cope with that? And one of the last minute breakthroughs was coming up with a provision that was limited to those kind of circumstances that gave the utilities a lot more certainty, but wasn't anti-competitive or viewed that way by the choice community. And that was a big breakthrough for us. And then was also making sure that overall the package was balanced. I mean, you don't get 79 votes in the House and only 4 no votes in the Senate unless you've managed to get a lot of people's concerns addressed. And so I think it was solving that puzzle while keeping that balance that consumed a lot of our time, but obviously to really great results.
And then going back again kind of to the implementation side, how is this going to change what the Agency for Energy needs to do? What does it change what the Public Service Commission does? Kind of how do any basic operations of either of those agencies change as a result of what we've just implemented?
Yeah, there's a lot of new work for both the Public Service Commission and the Michigan Agency for Energy, even some new work for DEQ and ratepayer advocates as we have new proceedings and more of them. So one of the things we're looking very much at is implementation. At one point, our legislative assistant prepared for us a list of all the things we had to do in the bill and by what deadline. And the chairman was actually hosting a national conference that she, or regional conference that she is the president of at the time. And we did a call with her, and I said, okay, you should open that attachment, but please come home after you do, because it's a long list of things. But again, things that we really feel are going to be beneficial for the people of Michigan, so we're excited to get to work.
One other thing that kind of came up on the energy realm right before the energy package passed is consumers announced that they're going to end their power purchase agreement with the owner of the Palisades nuclear plant. Obviously, that's still something that's going to be playing out despite the energy package passing. Is there anything in the package that maybe would prevent or address situations like that where we have an early termination of a power purchase agreement for a variety of reasons? Does the energy legislation address that issue or the issues that kind of led to that at all?
Well, I think the filings themselves that come for the Public Service Commission's approval would come prior to the effective date of the legislation, so would be under our current rules. But overall, in terms of making sure that when something is really important for reliability and people are relying on it, everybody's paying for it, I think that that will help a great deal. And then just in the short term, obviously, we're watching this very carefully. And the governor also is committed to the local community that sort of regardless of the decision and not prejudging it, there are a lot of very economically challenged communities in that area, and is committed the Department of Treasury to work with local governments, my agency to make sure that the energy needs are thought of, but also that we work together to understand the impacts of that, and then the Town Investment Agency so that no one's going to lose their job even if the proposal is approved before 2018, but we want to be ready because those are some really talented people, some really great Michiganders. We want to make sure that their transition to their next job is seamless.
Mm-hmm. So at this vantage point, is it more of a, are we concerned about a reliability standpoint of losing that power off the grid? Or is it more of kind of what the governor talked about and you have about kind of the economic impacts locally felt?
Oh, well, I think it's a variety. You know, the Public Service Commission has to weigh this for, are the proposed savings really there? What kind of replacements do we have? What effect on reliability will that have? That's really properly their jurisdiction. And they did an order yesterday asking for information on a wide range of topics, including those. What I do is policy. That's not my call to make, but it's really important that whatever the energy decisions are that have ramifications, we're there to help the community. And if the at the end of the day, the plant stays open, our help for the community will be very much appreciated. And if it closes, it will be crucial that we were on the ground early. So that's what we're focused on. That's simply because we know the Public Service Commission is going to look very closely at the other implications.
Okay. We'll be following that and how the energy package plays out and implementation and policy. Again, thank you to Valerie Brader, the director of the Michigan Agency for Energy. Thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for staying up all night with us at least once.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. I'd like to thank, first of all, Abigail Walls for coming in on a day off to participate in this lively discussion. Appreciate it, Simon and Jacob. This discussion went probably a lot longer than you thought, and it's going to put you guys back a little farther than you probably wanted to be given the workload today. But thank you for participating. Really appreciate it. And John, and guiding our discussion and having a rocking party on Monday night and all the sweets that are still downstairs that I've gorged myself on.
It's the MERS Calorie Fest continues for yet another day.
Here I am trying to count my calories and all, and I've already lost count on the number of goodies I've stuffed in my face down there. Thanks a lot, John, for that and your guidance this year. And also Valerie Brader for making time with us today. Really appreciate it.
I'd also like to give a shout out to John's the black IPA that he made for his holiday.
Oh, that was a good.
It was a particularly good beer.
Yeah, I did like the black IPA. Of the three, I think that one was almost bottle worthy, I think.
We went through 5 gallons that night.
We went through 5 gallons?
Five gallons of that stuff went up in smoke Monday night.
The black IPA?
Black IPA, completely blown.
Wow, well, I think that says something about the black IPA.
You've got a list for next year.
Yes, absolutely. That was good brew. Hope everyone had a Merry Christmas and enjoy your next week here. Till next time, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.